It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, everybody. John Donvan here, and this is Intelligence Squared. And you're about to hear a debate on the Supreme Court and the nomination of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. We're doing that with two leading constitutional scholars, both really experts, both deeply committed to their points of view, and their points of view clash dramatically on the question of what a future Justice Amy Coney Barrett might mean, both for the law and for this nation of ours. But before we do that, I want to solicit your opinion on a totally different topic. Here's the question. Do you think that the national debt and the deficit are issues that we really should be worrying about a lot? I'm asking because it's become an extremely timely question, with governments around the world spending huge sums of money to combat the coronavirus, in many cases printing money to be able to pay for all of that. So it's such a complicated, timely, important issue, we are going to be putting it up for debate. We're going to be recording that in a few weeks in partnership with Bloomberg Television, and we want to hear from you how you would argue the question. And what we're doing, and we've done this once already and it worked really, really well, is we gather arguments from all of you, everybody in the Intelligence Squared community around the world, and then we run those arguments through IBM Watson. Yes, that IBM Watson, the artificial intelligence system. And that system will sort your arguments and then share them with our debaters during the debate itself. So be a part of our new television series on Bloomberg by submitting your argument at ibm.com/debatable. That's ibm.com/debatable. That link is in our show notes too, so you can find it there. All right, now onto the topic at hand, the Supreme Court and the nomination of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Our debate's going to center on three questions, and I'm going to put them to each of our debaters in turn. This is part of our new Agree to Disagree podcast series. I sat down with Sai Prakash and Erwin Chemerinsky for this one. Sai is a law professor at the University of Virginia. He actually testified in Judge Barrett's behalf in the Senate confirmation hearings. Erwin is a dean at Berkeley Law School. Both are celebrated law scholars, and they agreed to debate this incredibly important topic with us. So let's hear it. So the topic I want to go to now is on the question of timing, the fact that this nomination is coming rather late in the fourth year of a president's term has made it controversial. In fact, timing of nominations to the Supreme Court has been controversial now for 4 or 5 years for a variety of reasons. So that's the first question I would like each of you to tell me your position on. On the question, should the Senate be voting on a nomination to the Supreme Court right now? Sai, are you yes or no on that?
I'm a yes, John.
All right, Sai, you are a yes. On the same question, Erwin, should the Senate be voting on a justice to the Supreme Court now, yes or no?
No, Amy Coney Barrett should not be confirmed at this time.
All right, thank you. I want to go first to you, Sai, for your reasons. Why are you a yes on the question of the timing of the nomination right now?
Well, on the question of timing, I think the Senate has the authority to consent. The president has nominated someone, and I don't see any reason why the Senate can't act. The Senate is doing other things. It's considering coronavirus relief. And of course, it can legislate until the members leave. And so nothing prevents the president from nominating someone. Nothing prevents the Senate from acting upon that nomination. And I think there are three positions, John. I think one position is you must vote on the nomination. And I think that was Erwin's position 4 years ago. A second position is you can vote on the nomination, but you shouldn't. That might be Erwin's position today. And I have the middle position, which is you can vote on the nomination and you should.
All right. Thank you. Erwin, I'm going to take it back to you. So what I hear Sai saying is the Senate has every legal and constitutional right to be doing this now.
They certainly have the legal and constitutional right to do it, but they shouldn't do it. This is stunning hypocrisy by the Republicans. 4 years ago, Senator Mitch McConnell said, the American people should have a voice in the selection of the next Supreme Court justice. Therefore, this vacancy should not be filled until we have a new president. Antonin Scalia died in February 2016. President Obama named Merrick Garland for that seat in March of 2016. That was 8 months before the election was to be held, and the Republicans wouldn't hold hearings or wouldn't hold a vote. Ruth Bader Ginsburg died on September 18th of 2020, and already the Republicans are looking to fill that seat. There is historical precedent. On October 12th, 1864, Chief Justice Roger Taney died, but President Abraham Lincoln didn't try to fill the vacancy in the month before the election. Or in 1956, Justice Sherman Minton resigned from the court, but President Eisenhower didn't try to pick the successor. Instead, on October 15th, he made a recess appointment of a Democrat, William Brennan, so whoever won the election would pick the successor.
All right. Erwin, let me jump in because I want to give Sai a chance to respond to some of what you're saying. So, Sai, I think we heard from Erwin saying that 8 months was enough of a lead time, and they were talking about the case of Merrick Garland back in 2016, but that 1 month, 1.5 months is too short, and he cites precedent of other examples with where presidents had more of that time frame. So what's your response to that?
John, I think Erwin's making a slightly different point. I think if this vacancy had arisen 8 months ago, I think Erwin would be making the same exact point, which is what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So it's not really a question of timing. There's plenty of time, as Erwin and other people know. There's going to be a vote in the Senate. So I think the point is about equity. I think the point is about precedent. And Erwin has some precedents, but of course, you can go back to previous administrations and cite other precedents. John Marshall was appointed days before John Adams left the presidency. Stephen Breyer was nominated and appointed to the circuit court after Jimmy Carter lost. So there are precedents, obviously, for acting after the election, let alone before. I understand there's some raw feelings about what happened 4 years ago, and I understand that people have flipped. Erwin himself has flipped. Apparently, Senator Connell may have flipped as well. I think, you know, it's unfortunate. This game of delaying nominations has gone on for quite a long time. I have a colleague who waited 2 years before she withdrew for a circuit court position because it wouldn't allow a vote. That's just power, you know, sort of power politics on both sides.
All right, let me bring it back to Erwin. Erwin, are you basically saying, in a sense, I think Sai is saying that your basic argument is it should be payback time, that if Obama didn't get to nominate Garland, that Trump shouldn't get to nominate Barrett? Or is there a principle involved having to do with the proximity to Election Day?
It's not simply payback. What it is that we shouldn't have Republican court packing. The Republicans were wrong in keeping Merrick Garland from being confirmed to the Supreme Court. But if the Republicans are going to follow a principle that a president in an election year shouldn't fill a vacancy because of the people to do so, then we should follow that principle now. It shouldn't be that the Republicans in 2016 will block a confirmation and then 2020 rush a confirmation. That's what I'm objecting to.
So it is Sai's point that you're saying that it's a perception of hypocrisy or inconsistency as opposed to the basic principle that you're not saying that it should never be the case that in the last couple of months of a president's term, he should not name a nominee to the Supreme Court.
If Merrick Garland be confirmed in 2016, I would not be making this argument today. But to have Mitch McConnell block Merrick Garland and rush Amy Coney Barrett is the height of stunning hypocrisy.
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that both sides are hypocritical on this point, right? Because everybody who said there was a duty 4 years ago is no longer saying that. I guess if everybody stayed true to their position, it would be, you know, it would be an interesting vote, right? Because I suppose that, you know, this wouldn't be brought forward, but other people would be demanding that it was brought forward. I think this is the simple point, John. There has been politics in the judicial confirmation process for quite a long time. There have been delays, inordinate delays. Many people have waited 2 years for a hearing, and that was basically politics. It was nothing else.
Erwin, is it ever the case, from your point of view, that it becomes not logistically too late, but too late in principle for an outgoing president to have this opportunity to nominate another candidate to the Supreme Court? Cy, given what Erwin is saying, the fact that this thing has become so political, does the process itself, including the issue of timing, throw into question the legitimacy of the court? Is there a sense that it's become so hyper-political that we're looking at a situation where the two parties are picking their judicial results, or at least trying to, in choosing somebody to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it's been the case for a while, John, that the parties are selecting nominees that they believe will advance a vision of the Constitution that more closely aligns with their party platform. So I don't think that's changed. I think if we're talking about the legitimacy of the court, that kind of segues into the third segment. But I guess what I'll say is, obviously, we'd be in a better place if people didn't have hard feelings about what's going on now. But part of that, I think, is, you know, part of it's what Mitch McConnell and the president are doing, but part of it also is internal, right? I don't think that, again, there's no principled reason why you can't act on this nomination. And of course, there's hypocrisy, but there's hypocrisy on both sides.
Erwin, do you want to have the last word on this particular topic?
The hypocrisy on the Democrat side here has no consequences. It's the hypocrisy of the Republicans here that's truly packed the court. What they did to Merrick Garland had no precedent in American history. And yet, rather than follow what they did in 2016, they're now rushing through Amy Coney Barrett. Opinion polls are overwhelming in saying that she shouldn't be confirmed now. It's whoever's elected as president in November who should fill the vacancy created by Justice Ginsburg's death.
Okay, I want to move on to another topic, and we've been dancing around it a little bit, and that is the persona of Amy Coney Barrett herself, Judge Barrett. And the core question that I want to get at in this section is basically the matter of her qualifications. Putting aside the timing question now, should Judge Barrett be on the bench of the Supreme Court? Would she be good for the American people? Cy, are you a yes or a no on that?
I'm a yes, John.
And Erwin?
An emphatic no.
Okay, so once again, a very clear dividing line. Cy, make your case, and you did it, actually. If people want to tune in and Google it, you testified in her behalf before the Judiciary Committee. You took 5 minutes, but this is going to have to be the short version. What's the case for Judge Barrett?
I think Judge Barrett is a five-tool player, as I said in my testimony. She's a fantastic scholar. She's a wonderful educator. She's a institutional. She's a role model, and she's an originalist. And I think that combination is magic for someone who wants to be on the court.
Erwin?
Amy Coney Barrett is as conservative as any federal judge in the United States. Throughout American history, presidents have picked justices based on ideology, but so has the Senate rejected them at basis. In the 19th century, about 20% of presidential picks for the Supreme Court got rejected based on ideology. It happened several times in the 20th century. Amy Coney Barrett is going to be an enormous threat to basic rights with regard to reproductive freedom, the Affordable Care Act, the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals. She should be rejected for the Senate on that basis.
Cy, your response to what Erwin just said, the reasons for that he would disqualify Judge Barrett?
I think the Affordable Care Act is going to be left untouched. I think the challenge that the states have brought and the federal government has supported is not going to go anywhere. I think it's really a boogeyman that doesn't scare anybody. And I think we'll see that after the election, especially if Joe Biden wins, and then the arguments from the Justice Department will flip. In terms of the other things, I don't think that Amy Coney Barrett is any threat to the Bostock case from last term or gays and lesbians. With respect to, you know, abortion rights, of course, she might have a different view about that. But not everybody shares Erwin's conception of rights, right? I mean, there's a genuine disagreement in this country about the nature of federal rights, the content of those rights. And Erwin, has his own view, one shared by many, and he's very eloquent about them. But not everyone has those views.
Erwin?
I think there's two questions. First, is ideology a basis for rejecting a nominee for the Supreme Court? And it doesn't seem we're disagreeing about that. And then the second question is her ideology disqualifying? I believe that anyone who takes the position that abortion is not a constitutional right should not be confirmed for the Supreme Court. And from everything we know about Amy Coney Barrett, she will vote to overrule Roe versus Wade. From everything we know about Amy Coney Barrett, she'll allow people on grounds of religion to discriminate against gay, lesbian, and transgender individuals. And in terms of the Affordable Care Act, we've got Amy Coney Barrett's own words in 2012 that the Supreme Court was wrong in its decision upholding the Affordable Care Act, and that issue is going to be back before the Supreme Court the week after the election.
All right. So I want to put the abortion, the Roe v. Wade question aside for just a moment and go back to the ACA issue. You said a moment ago you really don't think much is going to happen to the ACA. But I want to, since Erwin brought it up, I want to go into that point. So within a week after the election, the court, and if she is nominated and serving by that time, she'll have input on this. The court is due to look at this this Texas law, which wants to, this Texas case in which the ACA has been declared unconstitutional. And it's gone through an appeals process, and now it's come to the Supreme Court. The basic argument being that because Congress turned tax penalty for non-participation to zero, that essentially the reason for the whole thing to exist has gone away, and therefore the law itself is unconstitutional. So that's the question that's coming up. It's not really strictly on the content of the law, but on how it functions. And Erwin is saying this is coming so close that she has sent strong, strong signals that she thought the very decision that that led to that particular perception of the law, this whole question of whether the mandate was a tax or not, is what's being challenged. She thought that that law, and she was very vocal about it, was kind of a disaster, which would indicate Erwin's saying that she would be favorable to the idea of declaring it unconstitutional. All right, I've just said a whole mouthful there, a lot of supposition. I get it, but it's a little bit complicated. But it comes back to Erwin saying she sure as heck is going to try to take that thing away. And you're saying, yeah, not really. So I'd like to get you to take that on.
So there's three issues in the case, John, and it's very complicated. One is, can the states go to court and sue? That's a quote, standing question. The second question is the individual mandate now unconstitutional now that there's no longer a tax? And then the third question is, if the individual mandate is unconstitutional, must the entire act be thrown away because the individual mandate is so important to the rest of the act, which is typically called a question of severability. So if they get past the first question, can the state sue, then they'll consider the other two. And the first question is not obvious to me. The second question is the ACA unconstitutional when the tax is taken away? And I think there are already five votes for that. So I don't think that's that interesting. The chief has already told us that if it's not a tax, it's unconstitutional. The key question, if they get to the merits, if they actually hear the case, is, by deleting the tax from the statute, have you unraveled the whole statute, as you put it? And I think the answer is no. Congress deleted one part of the statute. They pulled a string. I don't think the entire thing unravels because they got rid of the tax. And I think you can sever the rest of the statute. And I'd be very surprised if there were five votes to say that the whole statute has to fall, whatever Judge Barrett might do on the Supreme Court.
All right. So, Erwin, by size analysis, even if Amy Justice Barrett were to vote for were to take the position that the whole law is unconstitutional, he doesn't think there would be enough support among the other justices for that to happen. Therefore, no danger.
I agree with his constitutional analysis. I wish the Supreme Court would agree with him. But I think what he's ignoring is that everything about the Affordable Care Act since the beginning has been highly partisan. Every Republican in Congress voted against it. The Trump administration is arguing to the Supreme Court that the entire law is unconstitutional. In 2012, Justice Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito voted to strike down the entire Affordable Care Act. Amy Coney Barrett has said Justice Scalia's judicial philosophy is hers. In 2012, she said the Supreme Court was wrong. I am not nearly as sanguine as Sai is about this. I really fear there are going to be five votes to strike down this entire law, leaving 21 million people without health insurance in the midst of a pandemic.
Okay, Joe, I think that we've reached an impasse on that. You just have different views of what's going to happen. Okay, I do want to return now to the question of abortion rights and Roe v. Wade. Sai, Irwin has said he thinks that Justice Barrett has made it clear she has serious moral opposition to abortion, and has indicated her sympathy in the past with laws that restrict access to abortion from the ideal that the right to choose movement would want to have. So he said that she's already starting to build a record on that. Can you take on his concern that she would be a participant in rolling back Roe v. Wade?
John, Roe versus Wade has been declared dead and buried several times. It's been modified by Casey, but it still exists through the Casey version of it, which is the undue burden version of it. And of course, the undue burden version of it was designed by Justice O'Connor and her allies in the court to permit more regulation of abortion. So there is no unfettered right to an abortion under Casey. There wasn't even one under Roe. And after Casey, it's far easier to do so. What Judge Barrett will do, I really don't know. There are lots of people who are pro-life, who don't want to overturn Roe versus Wade because of the disruption they believe it will cause. Believe it or not, there are pro-choice people who think that Roe versus Wade was a mistake. And so being pro-life doesn't tell you what you're going to do once you're on the court. I suspect that there are members of the court who are pro-life who have voted to either uphold Roe versus Wade or to uphold it in its modified version under Casey.
All right, Irwin, very interesting answer, because it's interesting that the judiciary hearings tend to try to tease out what a nominee's politics and philosophies are in order to predict what they'll do on the bench. And Sai is saying that's a little bit of a pointless exercise, because people who are serving in the court do not necessarily pursue their personal, political, and moral agendas once they're making decisions. What about that?
You don't need to tease out Amy Coney Barrett's views. She said last week repeatedly that she is an originalist, and Antonin Scalia's judicial philosophy is her own. I challenge Sai or anyone to show me an originalist with a Scalia-type approach who believes that abortion rights are protected by the Constitution. No justice in history is more critical of Roe versus Wade than Antonin Scalia. That only leaves for me the question, will there be 5 votes? Prior to September 18th, when Justice Ginsburg died, I felt there were 4 votes. Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, who would vote to overrule Roe versus Wade as soon as they could. I didn't think Roberts would go that far. I have no doubt whatsoever Amy Coney Barrett will. In fact, her limited experience on the Seventh Circuit shows she's going to be the vote to overrule and end the protection of legal abortion for women in the United States.
Thank you for listening to this special episode of Intelligence Squared. You may have noticed these days that great debate, I mean great debate, is not exactly very available. In fact, between the political campaigns and cable news, it really can be a challenge to find substantive, reasoned competition of ideas from people who may have opposing views but also have a shared commitment to intelligence and mutual respect. How much of that is there out there? Well, that's what we do. We bring you, and we bring millions of listeners around the nation, real, honest debate through our podcasts and television and public radio, and we do it all for free. So if you think America needs more of this kind of smart, balanced debate that we present, I hope you'll help us make it happen. Because Intelligence Squared is a nonprofit, and we are funded by you, our audience. So I'm encouraging you, if you can, to please donate to Intelligence Squared. There's a link in your show notes, and there's more information at iq2us.org. Also, we have a great membership program if you want to get more involved with us and our community, or if you just want to learn more about what we do. So again, that's iq2us.org. All right, now back to my conversation on the Supreme Court. Okay, once again, I think we've reached an impasse on predictions about what's going to happen there. But an interesting topic has come up that I'd like to explore a little bit. And that is the notion of originalism as a judicial philosophy. And as you said, Irwin, Amy Barrett has made it very clear that as a protege of Antonin Scalia, she shares his view on originalism and on textualism. And so that gives us an opportunity to look a little bit at what that means and what to expect from the way that she will think and write and rule. Sai, take us through originalism, what that is, and to the degree to which Judge Barrett has embraced it, and what that might tell us about the way she will think as a Supreme Court justice.
Sure, John. I think there are two main approaches to constitutional interpretation and implementation. One is this originalist approach, which asks, what did the Constitution's words mean at the time of enactment, either in the 18th century or the 19th century or the 20th century? Because, of course, we've had amendments, including very significant Civil War amendments passed in the 19th century. And the idea is it's not an option for interpreters to update the Constitution through novel interpretations of this ancient text, because if you're able to do that, you're really amending the Constitution under the guise of interpreting it. And the alternative approach is, I think, the one that perhaps Dean Chemerinsky favors, which is the living Constitution approach, which just sort of, I think, allows judges and political actors to reinterpret, reimagine, reconceptualize the Constitution to advance political or moral agendas of various sorts. And one way of understanding some of the modern jurisprudence of the Supreme Court is the court has actually done that in abortion rights or elsewhere with respect to rights that they favor, and then read out of the Constitution other sorts of rights that the Constitution actually protects.
And that tells us what, Cy, about what a Justice Barrett would be doing as a justice in trying to interpret or rule on the cases that would come before her.
So I think on cases of first impression, she would be an originalist, right? And she would be asking, what did the words mean at the time of the enactment? So with respect to gun rights, right, which was a case of first impression until several decades ago, or a decade or so ago, and she would ask that question. With respect to cases that are already, where the court has already decided certain things, every justice takes into account the precedents of the court, and no justice believes that they're going to start from scratch when the court has already said something. And even Justice Scalia, he called himself a faint-hearted originalist precisely because he was unwilling to overturn precedent willy-nilly. So there is no justice that throws everything out. Having said that, it's true that every justice, the liberals and the conservatives, all overturned precedent. They overturned a big precedent just last year with respect to the jury trial rights. So the question isn't whether you're going to overturn precedent or not. The answer is you are. The question is, when are you going to and under what circumstances, and what's your justification for doing so?
All right. Erwin, do you have any quibble with Cy's description of what originalism essentially entails? In other words, looking at the text to try to understand what was intended by it at the time it was written. We're good on that?
I think Cy correctly defines originalism.
Okay. What's your take on originalism? Good or bad? Useful? Dangerous?
I think it's a terrible way of interpreting the Constitution. In part, I don't think we will ever know what was the original understanding in 1787 or 1791 or 1868. It assumes there's a consensus that rarely existed. James Madison, Alexander Hamilton disagreed about so much. But even if we could know, it assumes we should be governed by the views of those who lived so long ago. Let me give you some examples. The same Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment also voted to segregate the District of Columbia public schools. That would then mean that Brown versus Board of Education was wrongly decided. Article 2 of the Constitution refers to the president and vice president with the pronouns he. The framers clearly intended that the president and vice president be men. It would then be unconstitutional to elect a woman until the Constitution was amended. That's why even originalists abandon it when it doesn't get to their results. The Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment created many race-conscious programs that regard as affirmative action. Yet justices like Scalia and Thomas, originalists, abandon originalism there. I very much believe in a living Constitution, but that's not a notion of liberal law professors in the 21st century. It was Chief Justice John Marshall who said, "We must never forget that it's a Constitution we're expounding, Constitution meant to be adapted and endure for ages to come. Through American history, there's never been, thankfully, a majority of the justices who believe in originalism."
Cy, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. I think Erwin just has it wrong. John Marshall was an originalist. He was making a claim about the structural outlines of the Constitution, not a claim that the words of the Constitution could have them mean whatever we want to. In terms of the claim that we shouldn't follow 18th century meanings, it is a peculiar position to say, on the one hand, we should follow a constitution from the 18th century, but not follow its meanings. If you're not going to follow its meaning, you're not really following the Constitution, right? So I think it's if you're going to have the position we shouldn't be following the meaning from the 18th century, your real position should be this Constitution is outdated and we ought to get rid of it. Otherwise, what's the point of having these words on a page? They don't mean anything. They mean whatever we would have them mean. I think that's the ultimate position of a living constitutionalist.
Not at all. The Constitution was intentionally written in very open-ended language. What's due process of law? Or what's cruel and unusual punishment? I believe that these words were meant to gain meaning over time. Otherwise, it would be absurd to be governed in 2020 by a document written in 1787 and what people thought back then, even if we could know it, which we surely cannot. And so we take the words of the Constitution and we give them the best meaning for our time.
So to bring this back and to wrap this part of the conversation, bring this back to Judge Barrett, since she is an originalist and the two of you disagree on the value of originalism as a judicial philosophy, just in terms of what to expect, are you saying that we should expect a Justice Barrett to start with an originalist analysis but move away from it if other considerations come into play?
No, I actually think the way the judges typically approach cases is they read the briefs, they look at the arguments, they look to see if the court has said something on the subject before that's not dicta. And that greatly constrains what they're going to do. They also look at the arguments made by the parties. If no one is asking for a case to be overturned, they're typically not going to do so. And it's only in those cases where it's really a case of first impression where I think originalism will dominate. Otherwise, it'll be amongst, you know, one of several factors that they'll consider. Right.
What do you mean by first impression?
So if you've got a bunch of cases about what the right to counsel means, right? And today it partially means you have a right to a counsel provided by the state as opposed to a right to bring your own counsel in. That's how they're going to approach the case, right? They're going to read, when someone says, my right to counsel has been violated, Your Honor, the court's going to read all the cases cited by the parties to decide, well, what have we said this before? What have we said before? Where's the wiggle room in our prior opinions? And then work within that wiggle room to come up with an answer, right? And maybe in that context, originalism will play a role.
All right. So
it's not a tabula rasa where they're just going to start from scratch.
Let me take that back to Irwin for a final thought on this topic.
Amy Coney Barrett wrote an article in the Texas Law Review in which she said, justices should not follow precedent when they believe that it's wrong. They should follow their best interpretation of the Constitution. Also, we're not here operating on a blank slate. We've had originalists on the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. We know how they voted. They consistently voted against abortion rights. They've consistently voted against gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender rights. They've consistently voted against all forms of affirmative action programs. Amy Coney Barrett says, Antonin Scalia's judicial philosophy is own. We know what she's going to do on the court. And to me, it's very frightening.
I want to move on to another topic. And it broadly comes under the topic of potential reform of the Supreme Court. But I want to start with one reform that's being talked about, and others might call it a travesty, depending on your political point of view and also your judicial point of view. And that is this notion that if Justice Barrett is sitting on the court when Joe Biden becomes president in January, and the Democrats begin talking about increasing the number of justices on the bench, which is a term called, always with disparagement, court packing, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? So that's where I want to start. The idea, I'll go to you first on this one, Irwin. Would it be reasonable and responsible for a Democrat-controlled Congress in 2021 to increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court?
Yes, it would be reasonable and responsible for a Democratic Congress and a Democrat president to increase the size of the Supreme Court if Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation is rushed through.
Sai, your answer to the same question. Would it be reasonable and responsible for a Democratic Congress to increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court in 2021?
John, I'm going to say no, but I have more to say in your follow-up.
All right. Thank you. Irwin, let's go with your opening on this one. Why are you taking the position that that's an okay thing for the Democrats to consider doing?
The number of justices is not set by the Constitution. It's set by statute. It's varied between 5 and 10 over the course of American history. 9 is a historical accident from 1869. As I said, I believe what the Republicans have done is pack the court by blocking Merrick Garland and then rushing Amy Coney Barrett. I think the Democrats need to restore balance to the ideology of the Supreme Court. And I think the only way to do this will be to increase the size of the court. And I don't see anything wrong with their doing that.
When you say you don't see anything wrong, before we go to Cy, I want to go to what I think a lot of people would see as being wrong with that, is that it would be such an overtly political move, and it would set off a tsunami of every 4 years, the incoming, if there's a change in power, that the incoming power would fine-tune the court to its liking by changing its structure, not just its members, but its structure. Not problematic?
Your words were an overtly political act. Blocking Merrick Garland's confirmation was an overtly political act. And then in light of that, rushing through Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation is an overtly political act. I think the Democrats need to take action to restore balance on the court. Now, you're right. If the Democrats do this, there's the possibility in 2024 or 2028, if there's a Republican president, a Republican Congress, they could increase the size of the Supreme Court. But the alternative for Democrats would be unilateral disarmament. The alternative would be to accept a very conservative court for decades to come. Amy Coney Barrett is 48 years old. If she remains on the court till she's 87, the age which Justice Ginsburg died, she'll be a justice to the year 2059.
That's giving me pause. I was speechless for a moment there as I processed that number. Cy, your response to the question of increasing the number of justices on the Supreme Court, you said you have a more nuanced response to that one.
Well, I think Irwin's absolutely right. I do think Congress has the authority to set the number of justices, and so they could change that by statute. I don't think that Joe Biden wants to do that, and I don't think it will happen, but they could certainly do it, and it would be constitutional. But I think you're also right that there would be a tat, right? There'd be a tit for tat. Now, so Irwin is focused on what happened to Merrick Garland, but as I said earlier, this has happened before. This isn't the first rodeo that we've been to. And the consequence of that is that both sides delay nominations in an election year, certainly in a presidential election year, and that has this consequence. Again, I know people that waited 2 years and then gave up. So if they want to do it, they can certainly do it, but the consequence will be the Republicans will do the same thing. And if, you know, that would just be a cycle. We've seen this in the states, and I think eventually both sides decide that this is a virtuous cycle. It's a vicious cycle. And I think if that were to happen here, you would see a tit for tat situation.
Irwin, do you think it's likely to happen if Judge Barrett is nominated to the court, is confirmed to the court, and if Joe Biden wins the election, do you think we're talking about that as a reality?
Yes. On Saturday, September 12th, I spoke at a conference at William & Mary Law School. And this issue was raised. And I said, if God forbid Justice Ginsburg should pass away between now and the election, and if the Republicans tried to push through somebody very conservative, I predict the Democrats, if they win the presidency and Congress, will expand the size of the Supreme Court. 6 days later, Justice Ginsburg passed away. I continue to believe if Joe Biden wins and the Democrats take Congress, this is a realistic possibility, because otherwise it is unilateral disarmament by the Democrats.
Cy, do you think that there would be an erosion of respect for what the institution of the court is if the numbers were to change? And again, it's been changed six times throughout American history, although not since the first half of the 19th century. So we've survived changes in the numbers before. And of course, the court's stature has gone up and down. But if that were to happen now, would that have a corrosive impact on the general public's perception of the court?
I mean, I think the general public's perception of the court comes from the court being able to sort of navigate between two extremes and being perceived as a neutral arbiter. Obviously, adding new justices, would perhaps change that. I mean, the interesting thing is part of the reason why the court has a sterling reputation or relatively sterling reputation is that the slings and arrows that activists throw at the court from both sides generally don't matter. But obviously, if you continually throw slings and arrows at the court from whatever quarter, it could have an effect on the court's reputation, right? Independent of whether you pack the court, right? It is possible to not pack the court and still drag the court's reputation into the mud. And that can be a combination of what the justices do, but also what people are saying about the court, whether or not there's packing. My nuanced, you know, I said it was nuanced, but what I meant to add, John, is, you know, there's a conversation to be had about reforming the court. There's a conversation to be had about what the ideal number of justices are. I'm not sure that's a conversation to be had, you know, when it's clear that one party is going to be, you know, adding all those justices. Right. But there are other more neutral reforms that would be well worth discussing. And this is a neutral reform in theory. Right. If you've got some sort of plan for making sure that one party doesn't nominate five new justices.
Sai, you had mentioned reforms, and I'm still stunned by this notion that Judge Barrett would be still serving in 2059, what is that, 39 years out on the bench. And one of the reforms that's being talked about and has often come up is term limits for justices to the Supreme Court. What do you think about that as a potential reform?
I mean, I think that's something, you know, that people should be talking about and thinking about. I think it's also appropriate to think about age limits for the Supreme Court and, for that matter, all federal offices. I think it's, you know, we have a interesting, you know, we're in an interesting place where both people running for president are rather old and many members of Congress are rather old. And there's nothing wrong with being old. I feel old all the time, but people understand that mental faculties degrade as you reach, you know, certain ages. But there's nothing in the Constitution prohibiting people from serving indefinitely on the courts and also serving indefinitely in Congress. So I think those are useful conversations to have about whether you should have a term limit or whether you should have an age limit.
Would you be pro-term limit and pro-age limit yourself?
I think the independence that is secured with a set term is sufficient. That is to say, 18 years during good behavior is just as good in terms of securing independence as good behavior. The only sort of marginal difference is that people can seek promotion, but that's true now, right? Circuit court judges seek promotion to the Supreme Court.
What about you, Erwin, on the question of term limits?
I strongly favor 18-year non-renewable terms. I've argued for this for many years. In part, it's because, thankfully, life expectancy is a lot longer today than it was in 1787. It was then 36 years old. Clarence Thomas was 43 when he was confirmed for the Supreme Court in 1991. If he remains until he's 90, the age with Justice Stevens retired, he'll be a justice for 47 years. That's too much power in one person's hands for too long a period of time. Also, too much now turns on the accident of history when vacancies occur. Since 1960, there have been 32 years with Republican presidents and 28 years with Democratic presidents. But Republicans have picked 15 Supreme Court justices and Democrats have picked 7. That's just because of the accident when vacancies occurred.
Erwin, I want to thank you for that answer. And I want to point out that it seems to be the one thing that you and Sai have agreed upon, except there was also the fact that you agreed to both be here and to address one another in a respectful and civil manner, which means that you've hit the target that Intelligence Squared always sets for civil discourse. So I want to thank you both for shedding light on the things that we can and should be thinking about around the controversy surrounding this nomination. And despite your disagreements, you both taught us something and you did it well and in an interesting fashion. So Erwin and Sai, thank you so much for joining us at Intelligence Squared.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Erwin.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Agree to Disagree. Intelligence Squared is a nonprofit generously funded by listeners like you and by the Rosenkrantz Foundation. Clea Connor is our CEO. David Ariosto is head of editorial. Amy Kraft is chief of staff and leads production. Shea O'Mara is our director of editorial. Damon Whittemore is our radio producer. Robert Rosenkrantz is our chairman. And I'm your host, your moderator, your debate referee, John Donvan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, promo code STAPLE20.